This is the inaugural edition of Through My Ears, which is the new podcast that UCSB's music department is offering to the world to talk a little bit about the incredible faculty, students, and staff that we share in this department. And so I am very lucky to be joined today by Professor Robert Koenig, who is head of collaborative piano here at UCSB and also is our new department chair in music. My name is Eugenia Siegel-Conti, and I am a PhD candidate in the field of ethnomusicology here at UCSB. So we're very lucky at UCSB because we have several components in our department. One of them is more like the applied areas. So we have piano majors, we have collaborative piano majors, we have cellists, we have vocalists, we have incredible nascent performers in this department and really incredible people who teach. We also have a portion of our department that is dedicated to composers and composition in various forms. And we also have a few scholarly branches where people study music and the ways that we work with it and the ways that it makes us feel. And those are split up into three different areas. Musicology, which is sort of a more traditional lens of music history, particularly coming out of Western Europe and the United States. We have a field called music theory that does a lot of things, including some music cognition, how the brain understands music, but also deals with musical function and form. And then we also have a field called ethnomusicology that works with a lot of different musics from all over the world and talks about what music does for us on a daily basis. And I work in that field. But I think it's so telling that we have so many students here who work in a practical field, who work as practitioners in music. And what they're generally looking for is ways to connect with other performers, not only with faculty, but also with their fellow students. And one of the things that is remarkable about UCSB's department is the fact that we have a collaborative piano area. So, Robert, do you mind talking a little bit about what collaborative piano is, what it means, and how it functions here on campus at UCSB?
Absolutely. This is so fun for me to be here with you and to have this conversation today. And thank you for describing our department so beautifully. Maybe you should be the next chair of the department.
Don't tell anybody you said that. Yeah.
So beautifully. But thank you. And I've been a collaborative pianist for almost three decades now. And this was something that, as a young piano student, I was, in my practice room every day, studying the piano and, practicing like a fiend. And was feeling pretty lonely doing that, even though I loved the music I was playing, of course. And luckily, at one point, I have an older brother who is a violinist, and I was about 14 years old, and he asked me to play with him. And I had never done this before. And we read through the little Dvorak Sonatina, and it was like, bing, 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 the light bulbs went off for me. And I was like, oh my gosh, why haven't I been doing this all along? And it was just the joy of making music together with another musician and everything that you could draw from that. And so that's sort of how I got drawn into the field of collaborative piano. Being a collaborative pianist itself is very much, requires the skills of a fine, fine pianist, but it's opening up a whole world where you're sharing the stage with someone else. And sharing the stage with someone else, I've always thought of it as in some ways, a bigger responsibility than actually just being a solo performer and being on the stage by yourself. If things go wrong on stage, you yourself are the person that can be worried about it or think about it. But when you've got somebody else there with you, there's a big responsibility behind you. It's all about listening. I often think it should be called a degree in listening instead of a degree in collaborative piano. Collaborative piano in itself, it's interesting because years ago, of course, we were referred to as accompanists, and that word became sort of toxic to a lot of people, and the politically correct word now is collaborative pianist. But as far as I'm concerned, I'm still just a pianist, and luckily I get the great fortune to work with so many incredible musicians that sort of shape my sensibilities and to get to share in that moment with them on stage.
So especially when you're working with these different musicians that are shaping your sensibilities, how much do you find that you can put on and take off the various skills that you're building with each of them? And what do you decide to keep from certain recording sessions or certain concerts? And what do you decide to jettison when you go on to the next project?
Sure. And you know, that's a tricky question. And it's something that I talk to my students with a lot, because being a collaborative pianist or a chamber musician is always about arriving at the best possible solution for yourself, as well as the person or people that you're collaborating with. And so it's all about discussion. It's about experimentation. It's about trying things different ways. I've always thought that there's no one way to do something, but ultimately you have to be able to come to some kind of decision-making process with your partner that is going to present your musical ideas in the best possible way and will show a truly committed performance.
So particularly when you're working with not only your own students, but students who are working on other instruments here at UCSB, or you also work pretty closely with students at the Interlochen Summer Program, mm-hmm. the Interlochen Summer Program that takes thoroughly remarkable high school students from all over the country, in fact, all over the world,
right.
and gives them a summer experience working with professionals like you. How do you find that experience, say, different than working with somebody who is, let's not say a hardened professional, but somebody that has been a part of the professional musical world for a longer period? And how do you think that that informs how you help assist in those circumstances and how to know when to back off?
Right. You know, working with high school age kids is really a whole different ballgame. What I find so exciting and wonderful about that age group is that they're really purely there at Interlochen in the summers because of excitement and enthusiasm and learning, and they work hard and they're just energetic, and it's sometimes, you know, it's refreshing in that sense. I think, you know, college age kids already sort of have their ambitions and their goals in place, and they know their plan for themselves and what direction they want to go. And when you're working with a 15 or 16-year-old that may not quite know that yet, you have to be able to offer them as many different possible ways to approach music so that they can find something for themselves that they love and that inspires them.
So can you give me an example of that process? Have you had anything, maybe perhaps this summer when you were at Interlochen, where you had to find the right language or the right approach or the right example for a younger student who is struggling to find their way?
I think it's all, so much of that is happening in the moment. And so as a teacher, when you're making suggestions to someone about something that you think might make it better or might improve, you have to allow them to try it. And you have to be willing to accept when they say, oh, I'm not comfortable with that. I don't quite like that. And so then you come to a different place and you think, okay, well, let's try this. And you see by suggestions, all of a sudden when that light bulb goes on for them and they're like, I like this. And then you encourage them to go with that as much as possible.
So I had mentioned earlier that we're very lucky and that we have a collaborative piano program here. How do you work with your students in order to encourage that kind of collaborative process with the folks that they are accompanying, whether it's on campus or many of them have their own careers already as collaborative pianists or as soloists or working in church gigs or whatever?
Right. The starting point, of course, is just being as prepared as you possibly can be as a pianist. You have to know the score exceedingly well, especially when you are working with someone else where there's another part involved. So not only do you have to understand your own piano part and be completely on top of that, you have to know exactly what's going on in the other part as well. It all comes with rehearsal and with playing together and discussion and ideas and sometimes fights, to be honest, and disagreements, but always having the flexibility to know what you think you can do as a team and what's going to be the best presentation and committed aspect of what you're going to present to people.
So your history is really fascinating. You grew up in...
in Saskatchewan. I grew up in a little tiny town of about 275 people, about 100 miles east of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, which is a beautiful city. It's got cold, harsh winters. I always sort of smile when I think how I've ended up here in Santa Barbara, which of course is one of the most beautiful places around and has the most temperate climate. And But, you know, maybe growing up in those cold winters inspired me to stay home and practice because there wasn't much else to do. And I certainly wasn't going to play hockey when I was a young kid.
But, you alone in Canada.
But, you know, I grew up in a large family of seven children, and we were always surrounded by music. My mother was an amateur singer and my father was an amateur guitar player. And I think that neither one of them ever expected or wanted us to be musicians necessarily, but they wanted all of us to have some kind of background. And so all seven of us took various musical lessons. And, you know, I played the clarinet for a while. I tried the cello. Wasn't very happy with the cello myself because I wasn't happy of playing an instrument where I didn't have complete control of the intonation. Whereas, you know, on the piano, if it's out of tune, it's out of tune. But my sisters took various band instruments. And people were in choirs. And so we were always around music. And my older brother was a violinist. And he and I were the ones that decided to pursue it as a career and to go forward with it. From Saskatchewan, I went to Vancouver. And I finished my high school there. And then I was very, very lucky and fortunate to get into the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia, which was just an incredible experience for me. And then lived in New York City for 10 years, working as a staff collaborative pianist at the Juilliard School. And then again, very luckily landed my first academic job at the University of Kansas, where I was head of the collaborative piano program there. And then UCSB, here I am 12 years later.
So at Curtis, the school has such a legend attached to it because of the amazing performers that have come out of that program and also because of the rigor of the program and the kind of not only support, but also pressures that can be placed on students. And I mean, this is true of many conservatories because the idea is to make people dedicated and capable and strong performers. How did you find that environment, particularly as somebody who was interested in collaborative work?
The incredible thing about being at Curtis for me as a aspiring collaborative pianist was the opportunity to work with not only my great mentor there, Vladimir Sokolov, but also the fact that I was in virtually every studio at the school playing for lessons for all of these master teachers. And so I think what I came out of Curtis with was this sensibility that was drawn on so many incredible musicians that I sort of had to bring together and make my own. And those days were incredible in that sense, and just the level of students that I got to play with. I think arriving at Curtis was really the first time for myself that I thought, oh, I think I can do this. I think I can actually build something for myself. And certainly knew that I deeply loved it.
So it's interesting that you say that the cello was not for you because you have quite a large project that you're taking on this year as a collaboration with one of our department professionals, Jennifer Kletzel, our cellist. So can you talk a little bit about that project and about the process of putting that together and kind of how the discussion started around wanting to put this together?
It's a very, very exciting project for me. When Jennifer approached me to talk about the idea of doing the complete works for piano and cello by Beethoven, my initial reaction was hesitation. And I thought, oh boy, do I really want to go there? Do I really want to do this? This is a project that has been done many, many times. And what could I bring to it that would be different or would be exciting for people? And the answer to that was actually very easy once I sat down with Jennifer and started playing. And these are very, very standard works, of course, that have been recorded many, many times. And I've played them many, many times, just not with her. And so when she brought her ideas to the table and we started having our rehearsals and collaboration, it inspired me. And I thought, okay, let's do this. We can bring something to this. We're committed to this. It's going to be a huge project. It's spread out over the entire year. We're doing three separate sessions, recording up in the Bay Area. And it's exciting. We've got one of them in the can and two to go. So we'll keep everybody posted.
So have you performed all of these pieces before? Are there any of them that you hadn't had an opportunity either to play or to record?
Of the nine pieces that we're doing, there were two. One of them was the Judas Maccabeus Variations, and the other is the big F major sonata, number one, which I'm surprised that I've escaped it all these years. It's a real piece of standard repertoire, but It's also one of the most challenging ones for the piano parts, so I'm excited to dive into it. And I've sort of put Jennifer off a little and made sure that we did that for the last session, so I have the most time that I can spend with it.
So you've already recorded one of these pieces. What was the process like when you're walking into a recording session where you know two of the pieces very intimately and have performed it before just with different performers? And right. So obviously there's a different approach. And one piece that is really quite new to you.
Right.
Yeah. At least new to your hands, if right. not new to your ears.
Well, and this, Jennifer and I planned this quite well because we also had a couple of recitals that were leading up to this recording session. And so we purposely planned to program it on those recitals. So that way we could get up in public and work out the kinks, as they say, and just see what the issues were going to be, what the challenges were going to be. And going into that first, that recording session, and it really wasn't a new piece for us anymore. And we had played it together several times.
How did you approach that piece when you started to work through it? What is your process when you sit down with a piece that might be familiar to you, but you have never played?
Yeah. I think it's, you know, the process is probably similar for almost everything that I approach. Of course, it's the nuts and bolts of going through the score and learning the notes and, you know, getting yourself technically equipped to be able to handle everything. And then it's starting to, once you're comfortable there, then it's starting to explore a little further, taking a closer look at the score. Especially with Beethoven, it's a lot of fun because his writing is so extreme in so many ways, and with real sudden fortes and subito pianos and just real ups and downs. And so it's really important to me when I'm first learning those pieces is to stay on course with what he wrote and to try to be as honest as I can be with the score.
And what does honesty comprise itself of in this circumstance? What do you think of as honest, whether we're talking about Beethoven or we're talking about Prokofiev, or we're talking about a new composer okay. that you're working with? What is honesty?
Right. I think honesty for me is, and maybe this comes with 30 years of experience, but just being on the stage, is being as true to the score as you can and not doing things or creating situations or ideas just for the sake of doing something different, for a gimmick or anything like that. I think it's just being as true to what you think these composers would have wanted. Unfortunately, they're not with us anymore and we can't ask them what they wanted, but I think with years of experience, we all develop a certain sense of stylistic considerations with composers, and that's where I see honesty.
And how does that translate into working with composers that are still living and that you can collaborate with as you are collaborating with
right.
instrumentalists too?
That's truly one of the most exciting things, is when you can work with a living composer, studying a new piece and, you know, looking at their score, but then actually being able to sit down with them and present what you think they wanted and to see if you have any understanding of what their intentions were, and to be able to talk through with them and see what their emotional state was when they were writing those pieces, or if they'd had a big triumph that day and it's something that inspired them to write something uplifting, or if someone had cut them off in traffic that morning and they went home and they were angry, or if it's just purely something around color or a picture or just anything like that that would have inspired the composer, so that when you get on stage, you can try to present that to your audience.
And when you're trying to stay true to a score and find that intention that they have, why is it that you want to privilege what the composer was feeling or thinking in their process and through the score, as opposed to, say, what you're feeling when you hear the piece, or what Jennifer Kletzel is feeling
right.
when she's playing Beethoven?
Right. And that's, again, one of the joys of working with a living composer, because, to be honest, in all of my years of learning new music, I don't know of a situation, or I haven't encountered a situation for myself, where a composer felt so strongly about a choice that I had made. And often, if I was doing something musically where I had made a musical choice, they would stop me and say, "Oh, I hadn't thought of it like that, but I really like that. Let's go with that." And so it's almost the same kind of musical flexibility that I feel as a collaborative pianist when you're working with someone. I think composers feel this as well. And they just want to see a committed performance that is going to bring some kind of emotional reaction from people.
So that's interesting. It sounds like what you're saying is not only are you collaborating with whoever the other performers are, and you're potentially collaborating with the composer if they're living, you're also collaborating with the score.
Right.
You are finding a way through the score that is collaborative and that is generous.
Absolutely.
And what you're calling honest here.
Well, and you know, for me as a teacher now, I consider it a real privilege when I've been able to work with these composers and to see what their ideas and intentions were so that I can pass that along to my students. And so this is the privilege of working with living composers, is that if we can continue this tradition of passing this along, this music will always be better understood for future generations.
Absolutely. So I do want to talk about the future of concert music, but first I do want to circle back a little bit to this project that you're doing with Jennifer Klatzel,
yeah.
Because
mm-hmm.
you have an almost unprecedented, very exciting opportunity to record in a place that's almost a place of pilgrimage for popular culture in the latter half of the 20th century. Talk a little bit about recording at Skywalker Sound and how you approached going to George Lucas's sound studio in Northern California and making that a home for this project.
You know, Jennifer and I talked a lot about this, and I mean, the Skywalker Sound is the site where it is, you know, outside of the Bay Area, is just phenomenal. And we were joking that recording at Skywalker Sound is a lifestyle. You can almost consider it a lifestyle. It's, you know, surrounded by mountains and vineyards. And of course, everyone knows the studio because of George Lucas doing the Star Wars movies there. And we're talking that Skywalker, Luke Skywalker. They had an amazing piano, a beautiful, beautiful piano that I got to record on. And it was just inspiration. And for fun, Jennifer and I brought a large life-size cutout of Beethoven, and the people at Skywalker Sound had a large life-size cutout of Chewbacca. So we put them next to each other, and they inspired us and gave us some good fun as well.
And which one of them was taller?
Oh, definitely Chewbacca.
Okay, that's fair. I feel like that's good. Yeah. So, I mean, if you wanted to feel nervous at all in that space, you know, you have both of them leering at you from the corner. That's good.
Right. But exactly. But you know, to be in such a place where some of the really great films, you know, where the scores and the soundtracks have all been completed and mixed, and just to walk around the facility and see all of the memorabilia was incredible, just incredible. So
I think we're getting a little sense. I think we're getting a little sense of the diversity of what you do and the various places that you go and how you interact with different performers. We've already talked about how you work with students at Interlochen over the summers. You work with graduate students here. You're collaborating with a variety of performers all over the country. And next week, you have a really fascinating gig that you have taken on for the last 10 years.
Right.
That has a very different kind of audience. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It's actually my favorite concert of the year to do. I've been doing it for a decade now. And this is a dear, dear friend of mine who lives in Buffalo, New York. And she had a wonderful dog who she adored, of course. And the dog became sick and was diagnosed with cancer. And she was pretty much being told by everybody that it was time, you know, for the dog to go. And she refused to believe this. And so she started a program at the Cornell Veterinarian School in Ithaca, New York, which is, you know, arguably one of the most important vet schools in the country. And they've started treating animals with cancer holistically. And so this is with acupuncture and massage and various other things. And it's been a huge success. And her dog ended up living several more years after the diagnosis and was pain-free and was drug-free and lived out his days very, very happily. And so there's a benefit concert that we've been doing every year, and she brings in three violinists that I play with on a pretty regular basis and myself to support this project. And so last year, I think there were maybe 50 people in the audience, and there were probably 60 dogs. There was a donkey. One year we had a rabbit, and it's a phenomenal thing to see that music can affect these animals. It's not just for all of us. And we always joke that in some ways the animals are better behaved than the people in the audience. They sit quietly, they pay attention. When we finish our pieces and people are applauding, the animals get up and they're wagging their tails and they're excited and they're barking. And it's really, really a special, special experience.
I'm hopeful that maybe we can get some photos.
Absolutely.
That we can add to the website so that people can see this incredible concert and get a better sense of the diversity of what you're doing between
right.
Skywalker Sound and going and playing
yeah,
for dogs.
Yeah, doing Beethoven and playing for the dogs. You know, my career has gone to the dogs.
Yeah, I mean, it's just such an incredible slate of opportunities
right.
that seems to make itself available when you deliberately want to approach things collaboratively
right.
and from an interdisciplinary perspective. I'm wondering how you see your new position as the head of the music department, the department chair here at UCSB, as an extension of that type of collaboration.
Right.
And how you plan on building on that in the department and between the sort of various branches.
And, you know, I think it's having been in the collaborative piano field and chamber music for the last three decades, I think that, you know, to be honest, I don't know what it's like to operate independently as a musician. This is my world, and working with other people and seeing what kind of artistic ideas and sensibilities they have, and then running with that. And so I hope that, you know, we're a music department in a very large liberal arts university, and we have so many opportunities for interdisciplinary activities, you know, not only with the theater department and the dance department, but often we'll see at the beginning of the year, we'll have students come to audition to play in the orchestra that are physics majors, that are biology majors, and have been playing the violin or the flute their entire lives and want to be part of that community. And that's the kind of direction that I want to go, or hope to go, with our department is to bring this kind of community. And when I say community, I don't just necessarily mean the campus community. I'm thinking very much about the community of Santa Barbara and even beyond that, and bringing UCSB and our students and our really interesting projects to the community. And this means getting out to the schools and getting out to our assisted living homes and hospices and things like this, and going into homes. And I've been so privileged to get to perform in all these major concert halls all over the world, but I want to be able to bring what we do into people's homes. And I'm looking for more interesting ways for people to experience music that is not in a 1,000 seat concert hall. And you know, just little initiatives like this that bring all of the incredible things that we do here at the music department at UCSB to the people.
That's really interesting that you put it that way, that you have an impetus, and so many people, I think recently, within the last 10 years, have an impetus to make music not only more accessible, but more intimate
mm-hmm.
for people, and
right.
live performance more intimate
right.
for people. I was really lucky over this last year because I was tapped to associate lecture for Music 114, which is popular music of the United States. And my students are so remarkable because they've grown up in a generation where they have access to all kinds of music all the time, or so many of them do anyway. And so many of them do have an inclination towards a lot of different kinds of music.
Right.
It's not only one genre. It's not only top 40. It's not only rap. It's not only country. It's not only, you know, drumming. It is a variety of different things. And it's not only that they just happen to like these different genres or types or artists. It's also that they use them in different ways during their daily lives.
Right.
And many of them talk about more like a classical tradition or a concert music tradition as something that they use wholeheartedly as a way to organize their lives and as a way to find some stillness or some meditation in their day or to calm them down or to help them sleep or to help them study. But many of them still feel a little bit wary of the traditional concert music tradition in that they feel like maybe it isn't pitched to them. It's not supposed to belong to them. And I think that they're so used to an intimacy through headphones that in some ways that's distancing, right? Because you go to these big concerts and Taylor Swift is on 8 different screens.
Right, and you've
got backing tracks and you've got dancers and you've got all of that. But then these students are listening to anything from anywhere at any time and making up a playlist for their life. How do you see the future of a concert music tradition, however we want to call that, that might invite my Music 114 students into that tradition? And also, how do you see this concert tradition in the training that so many students go through and work through, even at UCSB, right? An incredible practitioner program here in a variety of instruments, relating to a pop music paradigm or any other sort of music that's outside of that training that doesn't really fall into, whether we're talking about experimental music or we're talking about extended techniques or we're talking about some sort of musical idiom that doesn't rely entirely on sheet music or on name recognition of the composer. How do you think that the landscape is changing and recognizing how people listen to music now?
Right. Us as musicians that are privileged to get to do this for a living, it's our responsibility as musicians to make music accessible to people and to bring it to people. And this is one of the reasons why I think it needs to be brought in a way that is not considered elitist or stuffy, or younger people think of classical music as not available to them and not accessible. And so, you know, here on campus, for anybody that's been here on campus, our music building is so central to the campus. We are situated, you know, just steps away from the main library, and right across the street is our university center where the students congregate and they go and they hang out, or they're studying or they're eating lunch or whatever. And so I start thinking to myself, well, we're right across the street from them. So what's stopping us, let's say a small chamber music group like a string quartet, from picking up 4 stands and 4 chairs, walking over to the USEN, and just sitting down in front of Panda Express while people are eating Chinese food and having lunch? And when you bring music to people in that environment, wearing shorts and a t-shirt maybe, you know, we live in Santa Barbara, we live in this beautiful, beautiful warm weather, all of a sudden people perk up and think, oh, this is really interesting. This is really interesting. This is not like sitting in a 1,000-seat concert hall at the back where I have no connection to these people, where I can't go backstage after the concert and meet them necessarily. We can bring it to people so that they can come and have a conversation with us, just like you and I are having now, and make people interested in what we're doing. And then we can talk to young students here on campus as well about other things, other musical genres, and other things that interest us as classical musicians. You know, sure, I play Beethoven for a living, but when I go home at the end of the day, that's not what I'm listening to. And I have a very, very wide, wide, eclectic taste in music, which can range from, people will laugh at me, but it can range from being on the treadmill at the gym listening to Britney Spears, to be honest, to get my heart pumping, to listening to, I'm a big jazz lover, I'm a big country music lover, I love popular music. And my husband is a songwriter. He's been based in the whole Nashville world for many, many years. And he writes a wide variety of music, ranging from Christian music to Broadway music, to country music, of course. And so he's learned an incredible amount from me as a classical musician, but I've also learned an incredible amount from him as to how these worlds really are the same. And it's all about engaging and engagement and emotional reactions to something. And if we as musicians do something that makes people hate it, I would much prefer that than to have people just left in the middle, not feeling anything. If you love it or you hate it, you've had an emotional reaction to it. And that's a good thing. That's my long-winded answer to that. But, you know, we're very lucky here in Santa Barbara. Also, our community is full of cultural things. We have an amazing orchestra here with the Santa Barbara Symphony, and we have the opera company. Here on campus, we have Arts and Lectures, which is our wonderful presenter here on campus. And our students get to take advantage of some of the world's best artists that are coming in and have master classes. And you know, to be honest, when I get sent the brochure for the season offerings with Arts and Lectures, I sort of page through and I see the classical things, of course, which I mostly recognize and can easily apply to what we're doing here at the music department. But then I'm also looking at the other things. I'm looking at the fact that Kristen Chenoweth, the Broadway star, is coming here, and that Gregory Porter, the amazing jazz singer, is coming, and all of the other offerings, and trying to find ways that I can get my students to go and experience those things as well. Because in the end, that's only going to make them better, rounded musicians that listen to music and apply it to everything that they're doing themselves.
So I'd love to just end here with a question about you and your process and about your most recent experiences with collaborations that have surprised you. Because you work in so many different arenas and with so many different people, I can imagine that you have vastly divergent experiences with the same pieces of music or with something that you would think would be very not surprising and then turned into something surprising. What performance or collaboration has most surprised you recently, and what did that require of you?
Wow. Yeah. You know, again, like, you know, what's, I've been so privileged and fortunate to, over three decades, to have worked with various different generations of musicians. And so I've had experience working with an older generation, several who have passed away already, and to see what their sensibilities were from those days. And then I've worked with a sort of middle generation. And then now I've been actually recently working with some young 21-year-old up-and-coming musicians. And I think it's the younger musicians that constantly surprise me, that sometimes will be at maturity levels that is staggering for me. And this goes back to Interlochen too. Some of the younger kids there, when they make a suggestion to me as to how, you know, could we try something this way? And I sit back and I think, oh, wow, I had never thought of that before. And so I'm learning things from teenagers sometimes, or, you know, being presented with ideas that are viable and that I run back to my practice room and think, I want to try that. That's surprising to me still after all of these years, that especially as a collaborative pianist and someone that has been playing chamber music for three decades, that it's an ever-changing process. The process is always evolving, and it's what makes this profession and this field so vibrant, because you're never trying necessarily to do something just to do it differently for the sake of doing it differently. It's always going to surprise you depending on who you're working with.
I think this beautifully dovetails into what I really do want to end with, which is a question about what classical music is and why we continue presenting it, what the concert experience is and why that can still be important to people. There are so many calls, both in academics and outside of it, for a reimagining of concert music, of the concert experience. And often there are questions about why we keep presenting the same pieces, you know, for the last 100 years, the last 200 years, for the last 600 years. In some cases, the same repertoire has been reinterpreted and reimagined by fine performers all over the world. But there's also some hallmarks of class and of economic ability to be able to buy into these practices and the kind of training and focus that it takes in order to be a part of this world. What do you think pieces that were written 200 or 300 years ago and are being reimagined by performers now have to offer to the spectrum of musical experiences that are out there?
You know, as far as the music itself that was written 200 or 300 years ago, I don't think I have to really speak to why Beethoven or Mozart is still appealing to people. It's beautiful, incredibly genius music that was written all these years ago. And so people interpreting it now recognize that when they're playing it, and that's the value to the performer. But I think that what that music can bring to us and to our next generation of people is an awareness of artistic endeavors that can bring people into different directions that may be for them. And so when I say that, I think about people like people that I listen to again. Freddie Mercury from Queen was a classically trained musician. Lady Gaga was a classically trained musician. Alicia Keys went to Juilliard. And so their experiences in the direction that they went as artists was informed by the people that wrote for us 200 and 300 years ago. And so that in itself is enough to make it valuable and for all of us to keep the flame going and to bring it to as many people as we possibly can.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So this has been the first edition of Through My Ears, the podcast from UCSB's Department of Music. My name is Eugenia Siegel-Conti, and I've just been talking with Dr. Robert Koenig, who is the head of collaborative piano and also our new department head in the Department of Music. Thank you.